There will now be a 20-minute interval. You must return on time or you will be deleted. You must return on time or you will be deleted. Delete, delete, delete.
Well, the fact that the interval announcement was made by a Cyberman there and that the previous piece was introduced by Madame Bastra and Strax, a Silurian and her Sontaran butler, has probably given you a clue if you needed one that this is the Doctor Who prom live from the Royal Albert Hall. Radio 4's Sean Lay is with me. Alan Clayton and Kerry Ingram were dressed in red satin robes as characters from the Rings of Akhartan during that last number. Was that a storyline you followed, Sean?
Yes, absolutely. And a strange idea of singing a lullaby to a destructive celestial deity called Grandfather. I don't know what that tells you about what was going on in the author's mind, but I suppose that's one of the attractions for some pretty distinguished writers. For example, Neil Gaiman has written recently for Doctor Who, and it's a real opportunity to let your imagination let rip.
And it certainly appeals to a huge age range, massive age range of audience members here.
It is remarkable because you initially think, well, a lot of the adults are really here just because the kids want to go and they bring them along. And then you see the reaction of the adults on their faces, captured on some of the big video screens above us. But actually, if we just lean out of our box here and look among the audience, and when some of those monsters, those non-speaking actors dressed in heavy costumes that must be full of sweat by the end of the evening, it's so baking hot in here, as they careered around the auditorium, plunged into the arena, raised their weapons, or even just kind of glared at you, you could hear some of the screams and the cries of delight from adults and children alike. And it sort of, in a sense, captures the mix of fear and thrill that I think generations of children have felt, the sort of behind-the-sofa moment, only there's no sofa to hide behind here.
Sadly not. Well, there'll be some exclusive videos of tonight's concert available on the Prom's website from tomorrow, if you'd like to check them out. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in around 20 minutes, if anyone in the hall can bear to tear themselves away from the laser lights, the screens with their Doctor Who logos, and, of course, the blue police box, the TARDIS. But hang on a minute, someone seems to be making their way towards it. They look vaguely familiar. It's Radio 3 presenter Matthew Sweet. He's stepping inside. Matthew? Matthew?
Oh, well, thank goodness that worked. Hello. The Doctor Who prom is going swimmingly. The first half was brilliant, and I've just travelled back about 2.5 hours in order to make the programme that will play through the interval on Radio 3. So most of the people in this room here at the Royal College of Music are now over the road in the Albert Hall having a bit of a timey-wimey drinky-winky. Especially you, sir. In this programme, we're going to explore the sound world of Doctor Who. Special sound, they call it, and not without reason. We want the sound of the Doctor being miniaturised and injected into his own brain, the sound of a bipedal fish exhaling into a jar of water, or a pig-brained ventriloquist doll sniggering inside a washing basket. For half a century, perfectly sane men and women have been making this happen with valves, oscillators, rubber tubing, Baco foil, 50 pence pieces and Swarfiga. And now some of them are going to reveal their secrets. Tim Ricketts has been the dubbing mixer on Doctor Who since it came back in 2005. But his work with the BBC goes all the way back to the studios at Ealing in the 1970s, or the Pit of Cloris, as Doctor Who fans will know it. Paul Jeffries is the sound effects editor. He's also been there since Christopher Eccleston took the helmic regulator of the TARDIS. Nick Briggs is a monster, an absolute monster. Lots of them, actually. He's the Cybermen, he's the Jadoon, he's the Nestine consciousness. But most of all, he's the Daleks, aren't you, Nick?
That's true, yes.
That's not the right voice, is it?
Oh, hold on.
That's true.
Thank you very much. But I'm sure they won't mind if I say that the top of the bill this afternoon is Brian Hodgson, formerly of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, the man who, in 1963, using only a piano, a door key, some magnetic tape, and his own towering genius, created the sound that began our 50-year journey through time and space. Brian, when you hear that sound now, what does it conjure for you?
It's like time travel. I go back half a century, and it is half a century. It was a very strange thing. Warris and Verity Lambert came.
Morris is saying he was the director of the
original
story.
Director. And they said, we want a sound of something traveling through time and space. But we don't want it to sound like a rocket. So where do you go? I mean, where does a time machine move? And the phrase, the rending of the fabric of time and space, I don't know whether I invented that or Verity or Morris, but that's what I was working on. And it took me about a fortnight to really get my head around what I wanted to do. But I didn't want something that went up. I wanted it to go up, and I wanted it to go down, and I wanted it to go sideways. And we had this piano. I wasn't cruel to piano. No pianos were destroyed in the making of this sound. And it was an old Sunday school piano that had gone out of tune, and Desmond bought it for a fiver, and they stripped all the casing off. So we just had the iron frame and this. So I got my mum's front door key and started playing with the piano, drawing the key up and down the bass strings. And once I got those recordings, I started speed changing them and playing them together with each other. I wanted sounds to approach and depart at the same time, so I used a thing called feedback, which was very easy to do on the tape recorders we had in those days. And feedback sort of, if I said hi, with feedback on it, you go hi, 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 hi. And if you play that backwards and put feedback on again, you go hi, 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 hi. So it came backwards and forwards. I did that with some oscillator notes, some white noise, put it all together, and we created the TARDIS with a rising note and lots and lots and lots of feedback and delay. The trouble was, once we created it, that was fine, because it took off at the end of the story. But until I got the second script, I realized I hadn't actually done a landing. And so there's great consternation. So we did the good old-fashioned trick. We played it backwards. took the bang off the front, turned it round, put it on, put some more feedback on, and that's what it stayed.
Tim and Paul, when the series was brought back in 2005, you had this kind of archive of sound effects to work with. To what use did you put Brian's work when you were remodelling the sound world of the TARDIS?
Well, we had a meeting with Russell T. Davis, who was the showrunner. We said, Russell, obviously the TARDIS is coming back. What noise do you want it to make? And he said, well, just like it is, you can't change it. He said, that's the sound, it's got to be the TARDIS. I thought, thank God for that. That'll save us making anything. And but it's Britain's most iconic sound effect. Why would you want to change it? It'd be like, you know, defacing an old master, really. I thought it was just brilliant. It's still fantastic. It's still exactly the same. I
think but you did give it some strange tweaks, didn't you?
Well, it has been modified a bit as well. But basically, these sounds are sacred. They're 50 years old and they're sacred, and you can't play around with them. I mean, I took our piano apart and started at it with a coin up and down the strings. So Russell T. Davis said it's got to be the same, but I had to make the atmosphere track for the interior of the new TARDIS. And so, in a homage almost to the original sounds that Brian Hodgson had made, I took the growl sound, I sampled it into my keyboard, and then I played it at the very end of the keyboard, and so it sounded very slow, and it came a breathing type sound.
Shall we hear it?
Let's hear it.
Let's get it in our ears.
So that's the growl sound sampled, played at the very end of the keyboard, and it makes it breathing, because the TARDIS for us, when it came back again, it was an animal, it was a beast. And before, I think it'd been rather clinical and electronic. It was certainly very white and clean. It was always dirty and manky, and so that breathing sound fitted it well. But also the homage, it was picking up on 50 years ago, and it sounded like it was almost at rest, sleeping, and it really was, because it's the same sound.
Your TARDIS, Brian, from the 60s, was much more futuristic an entity than it is now. It didn't have this retro element to it, did it?
Yes. Well, it was very futuristic then. Nowadays, of course, it's very old-fashioned, but production values change. You know, that was what you expected in the 50s when, you know, space was bloop, bloop, bloop. it isn't like that anymore. We've had Star Wars, we've had all these wonderful films with very high production values. We couldn't go back.
Okay, well, 50 years ago, the first alien world to which the TARDIS took us was a dusty, radioactive place called Skaro, home of the Daleks. Brian formulated the Dalek voices, and Nick Briggs here performs them today. Let's hear the real Daleks from the 60s.
Dalek's master plan, apart from the noise at the end.
This is a test.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the modulation rate was quite high on that. The frequency was quite... I'm sounding
now
like
you can already
such a nerd
hear
already.
That Nick is a man who's deep into his subject. Now, you came to this armed with all of this knowledge, didn't you?
That's why I got the job, you see, because I'd been doing the voice of the Daleks for the Big Finish full cast audiobooks licensed by the BBC. I've been, you know, directing and writing and what have you, but I also said when we were doing the Daleks, I said, will you let me do the Daleks or do you want to see a grown man cry? And so we found out, you know, how to do it basically by learning from stuff that we'd read that Brian had said over the years.
So how is it done then?
Oh, well, I don't know technically. Brian can tell you that better than me, but I've got this thing called a ring modulator here. I can hear my voice coming through it now.
So this is a rather elderly-looking microphone attached to... what are those things below your feet there?
I can't possibly tell you, but they're very dangerous. That's a ring modulator, and that's a mixer. I've just got the mixer here because, as Brian will probably tell you, the secret of a good Dalek voice is to really overload the mic signal to make it not quite distorted, but quite fluffy. You know, and then you send that through the ring modulator and you can hear it just furring up my voice now like that. And then you get the full effect like that. You will be exterminated! Thank you. You will all make good Daleks.
The voice has changed over the years then, did they?
It has changed a bit. I remember talking to Dick Mills, who did lots of sound design for Doctor Who with you, Brian, and asking him why, in my anoraki way, I said, why does the Dalek voice change? And Dick sort of made a brave fist of explaining this, and he went, oh, we just forgot to write down the setting. You know? So we just made it up every time.
I'm sorry, that's one of Dick's stories.
Brian, what do you remember about how you formulated how these creatures should sound, how their personalities were reflected in this voice?
Well... you depend very much on the actor. If you can't get the actor to do the performance, then it won't work properly. So I was very lucky. I was working with another genius, Peter Hawkins. And the original treatment of the voice with the ring modulator was for a different robot, rather polite robot, on a children's radio program called Sword from the Stars. And that was a much more gentle butler-type robot. So that when it had to become a nasty robot, we tweaked the modulation. And the modulation is actually should be, the original Dalek modulation is 30 cycles, which we reckoned that was about the most intelligible. And at one point, I think there was a boss Dalek, and we modulated him as a combination of 100 and 30 cycles together, just to differentiate the boss and the... serfs, so to speak.
So, Tim, is the Dalek voice something that's sort of made in the microphone, as it were, made with that gizmo that Nick has under his feet? Or these days, do you take it and do something else to it as well?
Well, sometimes we take Nick's device straight from location, because often it's very good. We also take a clean feed of Nick's mic, so we've always got Nick clean on I was going to say tape, but it's not tape, in the box. So we've got Nick's voice, and then we've got our own... We got another ring modulator in bass, so we can also use that to recreate that. But I think really the secret of the Dalek voice is not so much the gizmo, but the acting. It's all in the acting.
And well, the ghosts obviously of previous actors who have yeah played the Daleks survive in your performance, don't they, Nick?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a homage to, you know, Peter Hawkins. And I kind of try to get the various different old Dalek voices in there. I put their names on my script. You know, there's a Peter and a Roy and a David.
Can you give us a demo, the difference between these?
Oh, well, the
Peter Hawkins one is the... my favourite one, who talks like this. But then you have the Roy Skelton one. He used to play Zippy on Rainbow. So there is that kind of tone to his voice.
The David Graham one, I can't really... He had this way of talking that was very disturbing.
Yeah. Brilliant, though. They were, you know, they're an inspiration. It's that business about overloading the mic signal into the ring modulator. It's really difficult to get a sound engineer to do that. They want, and there have been a couple of occasions on the new series where I haven't felt the voice sounded quite right because they just wouldn't overload it enough. So I bring my own mixer along now and I provide them with the overloaded signal. They can't do anything about it.
Okay, well, I think it's time now for a bit of a masterclass in one of the new Doctor Who monster voices. Paul and Tim, for a recent episode called Cold War, you had to revive a monster from Brian's era of the programme, the Ice Warriors of Mars. We're going to hear now how they sounded in 1967.
Supposing someone sees you...
I shall kill them.
What is that?
So, Tim, that was the original Varga the Ice Warrior, played by Bernard Breslau,
yeah,
from the Carry On film.
That's the 1967 version. They don't make him like that anymore.
So what did you do to this?
Well, we wanted it to be, you know, true to the character from 1967, so we obviously, you know, had to listen to that, trying to work out what they'd done, although Brian's now told us, so we could have saved us a lot of time. We'd asked him. So if we play... I think that 1967 click, a lot of it's in the acting with the s in the voice, it was all shh, which obviously Nick did. So if we can play Nick's, this is Nick completely clean, so if we can play Nick completely clean voice.
You attacked me. Martian law decrees that the people of this planet are forfeit.
So we've got a bit of Nick there. That's completely clean. Nick in front of a microphone, just acting. So we took that and then we dropped the pitch of it so we can hear Nick drop down in pitch.
You attacked me. Martian law decrees that the people of this planet are forfeit.
So we had those two together and then we needed something on top of it to make it. I didn't think there was enough threat in it, so I thought it needed a bit more something. So we came up with this effects track which we're going to hear now. So that's the sound of a beluga whale messed about with a bit. Well, I must say, no whales were harmed in the making of this show. So we added the two nicks, a few more breaths, and the clicks, and we put them together, and now we'll hear the finished Skaldak.
You attacked me. Martian law decrees that the people of this planet are forfeit. I now have all the information I require. It will take only one missile to begin the process to end this Cold War.
There we go, new Skaldak.
Wow, brilliant. And was it important, because this is a living, breathing creature, yeah, rather than something robotic, that underneath this there should be the sound of an animal, something organic?
Yes, yeah, so you need to keep need to hear the dialogue, so you can't go too far with it. So I think those clicks just do they just set you
it's
in another
really
world,
nice
and it's
touch.
Spooky.
I love
and,
that, yeah.
And also, you know, when he's not doing anything, he can still click away, so you know he's there in the background. You go, oh, this is a bit dodgy.
Yeah. Before we go, I want to ask you one last thing. I wonder what you think about what part that sound has played in the longevity of Doctor Who. How have these atmospheres associated with the series helped to place it in the landscape of the culture, Nick?
Oh, well, I can only speak personally, and, you know, they inhabit my brain.
you know. Your sounds are haunting. Do you know what? In those days, in those old days, we didn't have video recorders, so I would tape record Doctor Who to remember it. So for me, Doctor Who is very much a sound thing, which is why I've gone on to work on Doctor Who on sound. Your sounds, Brian, were just amazing.
Paul, what part does it play?
Well, I mean, you're also in awe of what's gone before, but it's 50 years. You know, I was born when it started, but I always try and get something out of the archive and slip it in whenever I can, just to create that special feel. And so it's never far away, and I hope you appreciate that.
Tim?
Well, I think there's two things in Doctor Who that really work. One is it's the start of the theme tune, which is that scream, which Russell always called the call from the kitchen. So even if you've forgotten it's on, you hear that, you go, Doctor Who's on, you have to dash into the sitting room and watch it. And the other one is the sound of Brian's TARDIS, because it's such an iconic sound. And, you know, if anybody in Britain these days, any show on television, if they want to demonstrate time travel, it's always the sound of the TARDIS, and it's never been bettered.
Brian, what role has it played? How much does Doctor Who owe to the strange sounds that we hear when we watch it?
I think in the beginning it was very difficult to get sets that didn't wobble and doors that would open properly on cue. And the sound just gave it another element so that you weren't constantly sort of troubled by all the strange other things that were going on. It gave it sort of homogeneity and created a new world.
And that's where we have to press the fast return switch, I'm afraid, and get back to the end of the interval on Saturday night. But before we enter the vortex, there's just time to thank our guests. Tim Ricketts, Paul Jeffries, Nick Briggs and Brian Hodgson. Set the controls for the Albert Hall. We're off again.
Matthew Sweet, our very own Radio 3 time traveller, arriving back from the Royal College of Music, where he was before or possibly during or maybe even after this Doctor Who prom, live from the Royal Albert Hall. Incidentally, it's trending on Twitter. Tweets from all over the universe, at least the US, Chile, Spain, France, and including some younger listeners enjoying their first ever prom live on BBC Radio 3.